Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. To listen to Business Movers 1 week early and ad-free, join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Download the Wondery app in your Apple or Google Play mobile app store today. It's February 1977 in a Chinese restaurant near San Anselmo, California. 32-year-old George Lucas sits at a table with a select group of friends and his wife, Marcia, whose eyes are red from crying. He's anxious and not in the mood to eat. George has just screened a rough cut of his new film, Star Wars, to the group, which includes fellow filmmaker Brian De Palma. It was a disaster. Even Marcia, his wife, admitted to a girlfriend that the film looked awful. The mood at these after-parties is usually upbeat, but this time things are different. No one is quite sure what to say to their dear friend George, who has spent 4 years working on what looks to be a flop. But there is one person who knows exactly what to say, Brian De Palma. The movie director is currently enjoying box office and critical acclaim for his latest film, Carrie, and he's never shy about giving his opinion. George respects De Palma, but his bluntness takes Lucas by surprise. George, what's all this force crap? It's a mystical thing, Brian. It doesn't need explaining. And the blood, where's the blood when they shoot people? Well, we can't have blood. It's a film for kids. Oh, I just don't get it. The princess? Leia. Yeah. What are those things on her ears? It's like she's wearing Danish pastries. Are you being serious? I am. And your villain, Darth Vader. First time we meet him, he's dressed all in black, strides through a spaceship with bodies strewn all around, and no one says a word. Well, there'll be music there, a menacing theme to let the audience know he's evil. Johnny Williams is working on that right now. George, you have to tell the audience who these characters are. We've never met any of them before. Well, what's your suggestion? Have one of the soldiers, stormtroopers. They're called stormtroopers. Okay. Have one of the stormtroopers say, "Here comes Darth Vader. Those rebels are in trouble now." That's a terrible idea. All right, fine, but at least do something about all that text at the start of the movie. You mean the crawl? The audience needs that information. You said it yourself. We've never met any of these characters or seen this universe. George, your audience has just sat down to watch a two-hour movie, and they're spending the first 2 minutes reading. At least cut it down. I don't know if I can. I've lived with this for so long, I'm not sure how. Well, let me take a crack at it. You think you can make it better? I don't know. But it can't get any worse. De Palma keeps his word and helps George rewrite the opening crawl, chopping the text down by half. But there's still a lot of work to be done to save the film. Even with De Palma's intervention, most people think Star Wars is destined for failure. But there is at least one person who sees its potential. Another director named Steven Spielberg. When a studio executive at 20th Century Fox, who's financing the film, calls Spielberg and asks his opinion, Spielberg tells him it's going to make a fortune. And Spielberg is, of course, right. Star Wars will become a pop culture phenomenon, revolutionizing the way films are made and marketed. The groundbreaking special effects will usher in a new wave of fantastical cinema, eventually making audiences believe that dinosaurs still roam the Earth, that men in iron suits can save the universe, and that a Mandalorian bounty hunter can protect a tiny green child. In the decades that follow, successful films will come to be calculated in billions, not millions of dollars. And the motion picture industry will wake up to a new reality, that the actual film can be one of the least profitable parts of the entire movie-making enterprise. For George Lucas, his stubborn determination and refusal to be cowed in the face of potential disaster will lead him to create an empire and walk away one of the richest men on the planet.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. George Lucas's story doesn't start in a galaxy far, far away. It begins in a little farming community called Modesto, California. George Lucas Sr. always wished for a son to carry on the family name. But when his wife Dorothy suffered periods of ill health following the birth of their two daughters, the doctors advised against them having more children. And so on May 14, 1944, the arrival of a healthy baby boy was a delightful surprise. Young George was an introverted dreamer who liked nothing more than escaping to the fantastical worlds of his imagination. He inherited a love of literature from his mother, immersing himself in history books and the adventure stories of Robert Louis Stevenson. George pooled allowance money with his sister Wendy and amassed a huge collection of comic books, so big it required its own shed in the backyard. The post-war years in America were good for the Lucases, as George's father built up his office supply business. Then, in 1954, there was another new arrival in the Lucas household, one that would have a monumental impact on George, a television set. At 6 o'clock every evening, he would sit enthralled as Flash Gordon conquered the universe and Buck Rogers undertook a new deadly trip to the stars. George became addicted to these exhilarating stories, drawn in by their cliffhanger endings. When he wasn't watching TV, though, George earned a weekly allowance mowing the family lawn, and his strict father insisted the job was done properly. But George was a scrawny, jug-eared kid, so he used his savings to buy a power mower. George Sr. wasn't happy, but he admired his son's chutzpah. That rebellious, innovative streak would grow deeper as George continued to buck against his father's tough discipline. Bored with school, George developed a fascination for art, and this morphed into an obsession with photography, encouraged by the equipment on sale at his father's store. George Sr. did not want his son to be an artist or photographer. But the real wedge between father and son would involve four wheels and teenage George's abiding love of fast cars. Determined to get a grip on this risky new hobby, George Sr. bought his son a small yellow Fiat, figuring he couldn't do much damage in a car powered by a two-cylinder engine. But the 16-year-old Lucas, who was also teaching himself the art of auto mechanics, ripped out the tiny motor and replaced it with something with much more punch. He spent evenings racing his new high-powered vehicle and cruising the streets. But the more time he spent with his car, the less time he spent on his school books. Soon, his rebelliousness and his need for speed would put George on a collision course with his father and with his destiny. This is the first episode in our four-part series on George Lucas, creating a Hollywood empire. It's June 1962 at L.M. Morris, the Lucas family's office supply store in Modesto, 15 years before the Star Wars screening. George isn't on the sales floor selling products. He's in the bathroom scrubbing toilets, and he's furious. He's spent the last 2 weeks sweeping floors, lugging around heavy reams of paper, and now he's cleaning the restrooms, all in 100-degree heat. George has had enough, so he puts down the toilet brush and storms into his father's office. "Geez, George, knock first. Show some respect. I came in to tell you I'm done." "Well, good. I'll inspect the toilets in a second. But in the meantime, there's another package to deliver." "No, no, Dad, I'm done. I can't do this anymore." "You're done? What do you mean? I'm not paying you to finish early." "I'm not finishing early. I'm finishing completely. I'm telling you, I'm quit. I'm not made to work in a job doing the same mindless tasks over and over, day after day." "What do you think you are made to do, George? Be a grease monkey for the rest of your life? Is that how you want to support a family?" Recently, George started hanging out at a local garage, earning extra money as a mechanic. It's an environment George feels comfortable in, and it offers more excitement than the mind-numbing repetition of the 9-to-5 his domineering father is offering. "Yeah, maybe I'll become a mechanic. or maybe an illustrator. George has a cousin who's a commercial artist for the Saturday Evening Post, and he figures that would be a fun career. But his father has even less respect for the life of an artist than he does an auto mechanic. And why would you throw your life away like that? Starving in some rat-infested shack just to do some doodling. I'm not going to starve, Dad. I'm going to do big things. George Sr. tries to restrain his frustration. He believes strongly in the value of hard work and applying yourself. A die-hard Republican, what he fears most is that his son will become that very 1950s boogeyman, a juvenile delinquent. George, I built this business for you. I bought it and built it up so that when the time came, it would all be here ready for you to come on board. Lucas and Lucas, father and son. That is your dream, Dad. It's not mine. And never will be. Well, George, you can leave, sure. But know this, you'll be back. No, I'll never be back. And I'm afraid you'll never amount to anything. Never, huh? Way to believe in your son. Lots of support. But you just watch. I'm going to be a millionaire before I'm 30. George Lucas Jr. was 18 years old when he slammed the door on his father. There was no grand plan on how he was going to make that $1 million, just a teenager's bravado in the face of authority. But he was right. He would become a millionaire by the time he was 30. Still, the journey to get there would be riddled with obstacles and near tragedy. June 12, 1962 was a blisteringly hot Tuesday in Modesto, California. George was just 3 days from graduation from Thomas Downey High School, and he still hadn't finished his term papers. So at the last possible moment, George went to the library to finish his work. George was a C student at best, and his ambition seemed to be no bigger than the next street race. But his love for cars had been rewarded with a host of trophies from various races across the state. But that love for adrenaline also gained him a number of speeding violations, much to the shame of his law-abiding father. After graduation, George had plans to spend the summer traveling Europe and then come back to enroll in art school or maybe work as a mechanic. But just before his summer break, destiny would intervene. George was on his way back from the library, where he was in a last-ditch effort to finish his term papers. On the drive home, George's car was struck by another vehicle, flipping his car 7 or 8 times. Luckily for George, the force of the 90-mile-an-hour impact caused his seatbelt to be ripped clean from its base, throwing him clear of the car before it wrapped itself around a walnut tree. George narrowly survived. When the ambulance arrived, George was in a state of shock. His left shoulder blade was fractured, his lungs were crushed, and his pulse was barely perceptible. On the journey to the hospital, George vomited blood and started to turn blue. When he woke up a few hours later, there were tubes attached to his body, one providing oxygen, another transfusing blood. And sitting in front of him, distraught, was his mother, Dorothy. Drained of his strength, in incredible pain, all George could ask was, "Mom, did I do something wrong?" As Lucas's mangled Fiat was hauled through town, a rumor spread fast around Thomas Downey High School. George Lucas was dead. And in one way, it was true. The George Lucas that went into that hospital came out a new man, with a fresh sense of purpose.
I made a determination in the hospital that I was going to go on to college because I've been given a second chance. And it's amazing what's happened in my second life. And it's just, it's odd because, you know, my first life I was sort of going nowhere. And my second life from that moment, really from the hospital, I took off and was sort of accelerating ever since.
In the wake of his accident, George decided to marry his love of comics, photography, and stories to pursue a career as a filmmaker. And 2 years later, on June 9, 1964, a reinvigorated Lucas received his arts degree from Modesto Junior College. Then George took the entrance exam for the University of Southern California School of Cinema. He had little confidence he would be accepted. And neither did his friends, who thought his dreams would lead to just one role in the film industry, tearing tickets at the local theater. Because in the early 1960s, even if you got into USC's film school, there was no guarantee that you'd get into the business. Hollywood was a closed shop, rife with nepotism. And right then, the motion picture industry was in a downturn, too. In 1946, 78 million people went to the movies. But by 1960, that number had fallen by over 70%, a seeming death blow delivered by the arrival of television. But George, who'd been developing his photography skills at racetrack meets for years, was a natural. Within the space of one semester, his obsession with cars had been completely replaced with a love of celluloid. At USC student festivals, George's films were showered with awards. But perhaps his biggest prize at USC was won when Lucas was introduced to a fellow Modestan named Marcia Griffin. Just as opinionated as George, Marcia was a professional editor who was disdainful of film students. Initially, George was quiet and shy around Marcia, but in time, their shared love of film gave him the opportunity to open up, and soon George worked up the courage to ask her out. Marcia was upbeat and extroverted, George introverted and pessimistic. But despite their differences, the two were well matched. They would marry in February 1969, setting up a home in Mill Valley, just north of San Francisco. And with a new wife and home, George began to focus on the next step in his career. In 1967, George returned to USC as a graduate student and teaching assistant. There, he used his students as crew members for his new film, a dystopian thriller called THX 1138-4EB. George's 15-minute short won a slew of awards, including Best Drama at the National Student Film Festival in January of 1968. Among those wowed by George's virtuosity was a fellow filmmaker, Steven Spielberg. And after the screening, he went backstage to meet Lucas.
My first impression was, I hate you. I hate that guy, man. He's so much better than I am. What a great movie, you know. How can I ever make a movie that great? And, you know, and George was a really friendly guy, you know. Hey, how are you? That kind of thing, you know. Hey, how are you? And we shook hands and became friends, you know, from that moment on. It was, the friendship actually began with a handshake.
Even George's father was impressed. Despite their early struggles, George Sr. had eventually come around to the idea of supporting his son's career, telling his wife Dorothy, I think we put our money on the right horse. But all the film awards weren't as valuable to George as what they gave him, inside access to Warner Brothers Studios. At the time, there was just one film shooting on the Burbank lot, an adaptation of a 1947 Broadway musical, Finian's Rainbow. The director was a 28-year-old UCLA graduate, Francis Ford Coppola. He was a legend in film school circles, an ex-student already directing in Hollywood. Fascinated by this larger-than-life figure, Lucas hovered on the periphery, studying Coppola intently. There on set, the two quickly formed a fast friendship. Both were grateful to have someone of their own generation on set, where the average age of studio hands was 55. But their difference in personalities couldn't be more pronounced. George was cautious and reserved, Coppola loud and gregarious. Still, both men shared a common belief that Hollywood was in its death throes and the generation of film students breaking through was the industry's only hope. To help make that happen, Coppola had been trying to create a self-contained filmmaking collaborative in San Francisco, an organization free from the interference of Hollywood suits. It was called American Zoetrope, and Coppola wanted George to be part of that dream. George was on board. But to make the dream a reality, something big had to happen. Something that would catapult the young filmmakers into the zeitgeist and draw other like-minded filmmakers to them. That something big was released in theaters in July in 1969 by Columbia Pictures at the height of the hippie movement. The independent film Easy Rider spoke to the growing counterculture movement. It was a hit film directed by Dennis Hopper, who would go on to become a famous Hollywood actor. But in 1969, he was just a young avant-garde director, just like George Lucas. Coppola took advantage of the moment. He convinced Warner Brothers that George Lucas was the next Dennis Hopper, and that a feature-length version of THX 1138 could be the next Easy Rider. Excited that they had the next big thing, Warner funded THX to the tune of $800,000, with George receiving $15,000 to write and direct, over $100,000 in today's money. Coppola also secured a loan of $300,000 to develop a slate of additional projects. So with Coppola as president and George as vice president, American Zoetrope was officially on its way. George worked on THX as hard as he ever had, saying that his needle was going into the red from day one of production. But when Coppola saw a cut of the film, he wasn't sure if it was a masterpiece or self-indulgence. But it certainly was George's vision, and that's all that mattered. The Zoetrope mission statement was that the artist was always right. Soon, Warner Brothers head of production, John Calley, arranged for a screening to find out what his $800,000 had bought him. George was excited for the opportunity to showcase his hard work and to find out if the executives at Warner Brothers would release the film. But the screening would be a disaster. It would nearly sink American Zoetrope and take its two captains down with it. The fallout of the now infamous event, known by many insiders as Black Thursday, would strike a blow to George's ego, put a strain on his relationship with his partner, and force George to strike out on his own.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's November 19th, 1970 in Los Angeles, California. 6 years before the Star Wars screening. George Lucas anxiously paces outside the Warner Brothers screening room, waiting for a verdict on his movie THX 1138. A positive response and THX will be a major studio release in theaters across America, and he and Francis Ford Coppola's vision of a filmmaking utopia will be within reach. Inside the screening room, Coppola delivers a presentation to the head of production, John Calley, and the other Warner Brothers executives. George is too nervous to join his friend. Luckily, Coppola's extroverted nature makes him a natural for these kind of events. Finally, Coppola emerges from the screening room with a blank expression on his face. So, Francis, how'd it go? They like it? No, George. They hated it. They don't understand any of it. They're taking it away from us. What do you mean? They're going to re-edit the film themselves. They can't do that. It's my film. Well, technically, it's theirs. They paid for it. Won't they at least let us take a stab at it? Now, they don't trust us. They don't trust you. But how can they cut a film they don't understand?
I don't know, George.
Did you fight them on it? I tried. But that's not the worst of it. Oh, my God. They're calling in the loan to Zoetrope. They want their money back. All $300,000. George is devastated. It's bad enough that Warner Brothers has no confidence in him or his film. But pulling the rest of the funding puts the whole dream of Zoetrope at risk.
Oh, God. What are we going to do about the money?
We? No. Me. I'm the president of Zoetrope. This is on my shoulders.
How are you going to afford that?
I'm going to do what all artists do when they're short on cash. I'm going to look for a gig. George was grateful that Coppola agreed to help repay the loan, but he had no idea how he would do it. Soon, George would learn that Paramount had been reaching out to Coppola about directing an Italian gangster movie based on a book. But Coppola wasn't sure he would put his name on something so sleazy. George convinced him to do the project. It would help pay off their debts and potentially save American Zoetrope. Eventually, Coppola did agree to that sleazy project and was paid $125,000 in cash and 6% of the box office gross. That sleazy film, The Godfather, would be a worldwide smash and would earn $300 million at the box office and come to define the rest of Coppola's career. Years later, Coppola would comment that its success would ruin his auteur ambitions and draw him deep into the Hollywood system. Still in the moment, it seemed like a blessing. George and Coppola were able to pay their debts, but American Zoetrope would never fully recover, in large part because of internal discord between George and Francis Ford Coppola. George had a vision for his film THX, but the studio had taken it away from him. And George blamed Coppola, at least in part. Coppola had shouldered the financial burden, but George felt Coppola didn't fight hard enough for the creative vision. And George was furious when he discovered that Coppola had used part of THX's budget to to cover American Zoetrope's overhead. For George, the relationship with his mentor and friend was souring. And ultimately, with these two collaborators at odds, American Zoetrope would slowly fizzle away. But the death of American Zoetrope would lead to the birth of a new entity, a company that George hoped would be his own dream factory. He would call it Lucasfilm. Warner Brothers released THX 1138 in March of 1971, but it was not George's original cut. The studio had slashed four of its about 90-minute runtime. The film opened to positive reviews, but poor box office returns. So this wasn't going to be the hit George needed, something that would put him and Lucasfilm on the map. George wanted to try something different. After the sterile, dystopian tone of THX, colleagues encouraged him to show a different side of his personality. "Don't be so weird," they said. "Do something with warmth and humor, something from your own life, something without robots." His wife Marcia challenged him to break free of his reputation as a cold, unfeeling storyteller. And in search of inspiration, Lucas would chart a course for his future by looking to his past and getting personal. He decided to tell a story based on his teenage life in Modesto. He called it American Graffiti. His youthful obsession with cars and music and girls would be dramatized as the lives of four young men on the last night of summer in 1962. George described it as a musical with no singing, the tunes provided by hits from the era, with the soundtrack acting as a character in the story. George pitched an 18-page outline of the movie around town, but no one wanted it. Studio after studio passed, believing the guy who made THX 1138 was box office poison. Every studio, that is, but United Artists. The executives at United were intrigued, but not yet sold, by George's nostalgic tale. George had to do something to turn their maybe into a yes, and he took advantage of a vacation to Europe, where THX had been selected for the Cannes Film Festival. On the way to Europe, George stopped off in New York to make an unannounced visit to the president of United Artists, David Picker. After their meeting, Picker was interested, but still noncommittal. It wasn't a no, but Picker told George to call him when he got to London, and he'd give him his answer. The flight to Europe coincided with George's 27th birthday. It was also the day that American Graffiti became a United Artists production. When he landed, George found out that Picker was in. The deal was small to start with, a $10,000 offer to develop the script. Picker, who was also headed to Cannes, suggested they meet there to finalize the detail. And so in a suite at the Carlton Hotel, Picker and George consummated the deal. With his next project confirmed, George was excited but nervous. He thought of himself as a visual filmmaker first. He loathed writing, a process he called bleeding on the page. So with $10,000 in his pocket, George decided to hire a proper writer to do the heavy lifting. This would prove to be a costly mistake. George found that the writer he had hired had no feeling for the material. When George read the script, it was so far off the mark, he realized he would have no choice but to roll up his sleeves and do it himself. So for the next 3 weeks, George bled onto the page until he had a draft of American Graffiti. The nostalgic story of teenagers cruising Modesto was clearly George's artistic rebuke of his father. And George was proud of the deeply personal script and excited to take it back to United Artists. But the studio executives there did not share George's enthusiasm. They found the script confusing, and seeing the scope of the rock and roll soundtrack, they worried that the price tag would be too big. United Artists killed the project. George was frustrated with Hollywood and tired of dealing with studio executives. American Graffiti was dead at United Artists, but George still retained the rights to the script, which meant he could make it on his own. But George was broke. So he made a painful decision that went against his very nature. He borrowed thousands of dollars. He was so desperate that he went to Francis Ford Coppola, even his father. It was one of George's lowest moments, but his belief in himself never wavered. He knew American Graffiti would be a hit. He just needed to get it out into the world. So George hired a team of writers to help him refine the story, polish the screenplay. And this new draft found its way to another executive named Ned Tannen at Universal. When Tannen called Lucas in for a meeting, George brought with him a cassette tape filled with music from the 50s and 60s. Tannen already liked George's work. He was a big fan of THX. He even shared George's love for music and cars. He understood the film immediately, and he wanted to make it on a budget of $750,000. But there was a caveat. Tannen wanted American Graffiti to have a big-name actor attached for box office security. George didn't want this at all. In his mind, American Graffiti was supposed to have a cast of unknowns, so Ned Tannen suggested a compromise, Francis Ford Coppola. By March 1972, Coppola was one of the hottest names in Hollywood. The Godfather had been released to huge success, making Coppola a powerful name in the industry. He was also, in Tannen's opinion, the ideal candidate to take on the mantle of producer for American Graffiti. Desperate to get his film off the ground, George reluctantly reached out to his old friend. American Zoetrope was still a fresh wound, but both men knew there was an upside to their coming together. Coppola would get to play Kingmaker, the man who made things happen in Hollywood, and George would get his green light. But there was one critical thing George didn't get: final cut. And that oversight would lead to another disastrous outcome. American Graffiti started shooting on June 26, 1972, almost 10 years to the day since George's car accident. Problems began almost immediately. The cars used in the film regularly broke down. The cameraman struggled to light the scenes correctly, and worse, on the second night of shooting, George discovered that the filming permit for his main location had been rescinded when local businesses complained about the film crew's noisy presence. The 28-day shooting schedule was punishing. George's workday started at 9 in the evening and ended at 5 a.m. the next morning. He struggled with the late-night cold and long hours. His taciturn nature hated being surrounded by people and dealing with the endless questions from cast and crew. George couldn't wait to get to his favorite part of the filmmaking process, editing, because that's where he was in total control. And it was in the editing bay that American Graffiti came alive. The addition of the soundtrack made the scenes bounce and gave an up-tempo flow to the story. George was proud of the film he and his team had created, and he was finally ready to show his work to Ned Tannen at Universal. The last time George was in this position with his film THX, he was at the mercy of a group of corporate executives that had no feeling for what he was trying to do. But this time was different. For one thing, Ned was a fan of his work. And for another, George had abandoned the cold, unfeeling style of THX, and he had gotten personal with his story. American Graffiti was a nostalgic journey into the past, complete with a familiar soundtrack of pop hits. Advance word on the film was terrific, too. There was no way it could fail. But just like with THX, this screening would be a disaster. Universal would threaten to shelve the project. And once again, George would be left frustrated and angry with the Hollywood studio system. This frustration and George's sense of deja vu would inspire him to forge a new path, one that would lead him to create one of the most significant films in the history of cinema.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
It's January 28, 1973, just a few years before the screening of Star Wars. Ned Tannen, the man who greenlit American Graffiti, sits in an auditorium at the North Point Theater in San Francisco. Tannen has flown in from Los Angeles to be at this preview screening, but in truth, he doesn't want to be here at all. His mind is on Universal's upcoming rock opera, Jesus Christ Superstar, which is a much bigger risk for the studio. If it pays off, it'll return far more money than American Graffiti. More than 800 people have turned up to see this film, and unlike Tannen, the crowd is loving it. George and Coppola, reunited for this special screening, are ecstatic at the crowd's wild reaction. But the louder the whooping and hollering gets, the angrier the film executive becomes. When the film ends, Tannen gets up and storms out to the lobby, closely followed by George and Coppola, who are puzzled by Tannen's odd reaction. George is anxious to ask Tannen what he thinks, but it's clear the executive is not happy. George is terrible at confrontations, so he watches silently from the shadows as Coppola does the talking.
Ned, what seems to be the problem?
Francis, what the hell was that?
What are you talking about? The crowd ate it up.
You mean your cronies and relatives? They're clearly planted here to make the film seem better than it is.
Were you in the same theater we were? They loved George's movie.
Well, I didn't. It's too long. It's clunky. It's confusing. It's clear the film can't be released like this.
George is quiet, stunned. He can't believe what he's hearing. But he's relieved Coppola is there to say what he's thinking.
Ned, you're out of your mind. You should get on your hands and knees and thank George for handing you a hit.
It's not a hit. It's a disaster. And there's no way I'm putting that in theaters. If we can't salvage it, then we're going to have to sell it to television as a movie of the week. That's the best I can do.
Tannen's offer is tantamount to Universal disowning George's film. The suggestion infuriates Coppola.
Well, you know what? Don't bother. If you hate the picture that much, I'll buy it from you.
Coppola starts reaching into his jacket pocket, searching for a checkbook that isn't there. Tannen stares at Coppola, stunned at the audacity of the melodramatic gesture, then turns on his heels and leaves. George turns to his friend, perplexed.
Francis, what just happened?
Hollywood, George. Hollywood just happened.
Coppola would remain angry with Ned Tannen for the next two decades, refusing to speak to him. George, who had been disappointed at his friend's muted response to Warner Brothers over the THX debacle, was proud of his mentor in this instance. Coppola had stood up to Tannen, but in the end, even Coppola couldn't change Tannen's mind. Despite George's protestations, Universal recut the film. George was stuck with an unnerving sense that he's been here before. When Warner Brothers recut THX, George jokingly said it was like someone taking his baby and removing one of its fingers. But this was even more painful. American Graffiti was his life. By cutting several minutes off the film, Universal was taking a pair of scissors to his past. Still, in spite of the cuts, George still believed in the film, and he knew there was an audience for it, which was why he was so frustrated to learn that Universal was essentially burying the movie, limiting its releases to just a few theaters. American Graffiti came out on August 1, 1973. Some critics seemed to confirm Universal's opinion of it. The reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle called the film tedious. This review stung George, and it was the newspapers his parents read. But still, George never lost faith. He believed in the film, and he believed it would find its audience. George was right. In spite of the limited initial release, strong word of mouth guaranteed it would stay in theaters for almost 2 years. From a budget of just $750,000, American Graffiti eventually grossed $140 million, making it, based on profit return, one of the most successful films of all time. In comparison, Jesus Christ Superstar would earn only $24 million. George was grateful for his success. He gave his collaborators sizable bonuses, up to 1% of his profit points to each person. His team hadn't asked for the bonuses, and George wasn't obligated to give them. But George just started a brand new company, and he wanted to keep his team happy and engaged for the many projects to come. It was a gesture George would repeat throughout his career, and one that seemed contrary to his reserved nature. He was almost always parsimonious with his money, something he learned from his father, George Sr. His only one major purchase was a one-story Victorian mansion in the town of San Anselmo. It was about a mile away from a small colonial property he and Marcia had moved into in the summer. Marcia named the new place Park House, and George had it fitted with offices, a screening room, and an editing suite, all available to their filmmaker friends. It was his own miniature American zoetrope. More importantly, George was able to pay off his debts, including the money he had borrowed from his father to get Lucasfilm off the ground. The callow 18-year-old who had once boasted to his father that he would become a millionaire by the time he was 30 had just made $4 million, and he was 28 years old. Still, despite American Graffiti's success, George was frustrated by the Hollywood studio system. Twice, he had played by the industry's rules, given up ownership of his films, only to feel repeatedly betrayed when his wishes were not respected.
The ethos of American Zoetrope was to honor the filmmaker. Whatever they delivered was theirs and theirs alone and not to be interfered with. George still believed in those principles, even if Hollywood did not. So with plenty of money and a reputation as a hot new director, George was determined to make his next project his way, without interference. The question now was, what would that project be? George had previously considered trying his hand at a comic book movie. George liked the idea of a big-budget contemporary version of one of his favorite comics, Flash Gordon, a sci-fi adventure story set in space. George had contacted the rights owners, King Features Syndicate, but the deal they proposed was so one-sided that he was forced to give up the idea. Still, the concept of a big-budget action film set in space was appealing. With the security of his American Graffiti money, George would not repurpose old IP like Flash Gordon. He would make his own space fantasy, his own version of the stories and comics he used to read when he was a boy. And the story George would eventually create would capture the imaginations of children and adults of all ages. It would turn the Hollywood status quo on its head, and it would launch George's career and his company Lucasfilm to new heights. George would title this revolutionary new adventure story, The Star Wars. From Wondery, this is episode one of George Lucas creating a Hollywood empire from business movers. On the next episode, as George begins work on Star Wars, he realizes that it's a film ahead of its time, and no one believes it can be done. If George wants his vision to become a reality, he'll have to try new methods and change Hollywood. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about George Lucas, we recommend George Lucas, A Life by Brian J. Jones, Skywalking by Dale Pollack, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls by Peter Biskind, and The Making of Star Wars by J.W. Rinsler. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Ayad Andrews. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship and Janie Lauer Beckman and Marsha Louie for Wondery.
Yo, Trey.
Yeah, Kevin, what's up, man?
I was just thinking, what would have happened if Drew Brees didn't fail his physical with the Dolphins and ended up playing under Nick Saban in Miami?
There's a good shot the Finns establish a dynasty. Tom Brady and Bill Belichick probably don't become GOATs, and Tuscaloosa doesn't become the center of the college football universe.
That's a butterfly effect for real.
Hey, I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass
or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.